Well, well, well. That is the Soul Jazz Orchestra with Mojuba. And the Soul Jazz folks are right out of Ottawa. Yeah, Ottawa, Canada, that's where they're from. And they're a really eclectic crew. They combine soul, jazz, funk, and Afrobeat, and the Latin rhythms. And, of course, in what you just heard, you did hear a little bit of Fela going on in there. A really exciting crew. You should get to know them. The Soul Jazz Orchestra. This is Lead Stories. I'm Retrieve Lead. It is Tuesday, February the 25th, and it is open forum. By the way, I'm waiting for the end of the day today. We're getting some pretty interesting reactions on whether we keep open forum on Tuesdays or switch it to Friday. So at the end of the day, that decision will be made. But certainly let us know. Just so you know, we've been having a little interference, and that's why I'm on the phone, as opposed to you may be hearing me sounding a little distant. It is just that we're trying to get around an internet traffic problem. It's not the PRN problem, but it is the speed at which the internet is working today. So we're getting so much interference that it is better that I do it this way. So still, we can be able to talk. Well, let's start off with Harvey. How are you?
Hello, wonderful Utrees. How are you today?
Fine, thanks. What's going on?
Well, I see a long-distance Republican plan to win the 2016 election. You know, like stations like Clear Channel and Cumulus, they've sort of swept all the major right-wing talk shows into the internet, and I guess their plan is to work, you know, people who listen to terrestrial radio now are all going to be subjected to Rush Limbaugh and Hannity until 2016. So I guess they're trying to recondition the mind of the average American. And at the same time, even though the 2016 election is a few years out, I'd like to talk about electronic voting machines. You know, a lot of them are owned by Republican firms. They have proprietary programs that we can't tell, and they're vulnerable to attack. And I say that this is part of the plan to win the 2016. They're desperate to win the 2016 election. So we have to return to paper, and not only that, but return to paper with a receipt. And I'm calling, you know, we have enough time to do that, because if we go with the electronic voting machines, for sure we're going to lose. And
are you suggesting, Harvey, that because the many Republicans own the machines, that many Republicans therefore are capable of sabotage? Are you making that leap?
Not only that, I heard that I've read articles about the last election where, you know, they can have somebody sitting in a car outside the voting office, outside the voting poll station, and just, you know, just manipulating the numbers from a computer outside of the in the car outside. So it's, yeah, no, we're completely vulnerable, and especially that it doesn't have a receipt. So I think that we have time now. Let's get back to paper voting and with a receipt if we want to see fair elections in 2016.
Okay. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
The number to call is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. We go to Baltimore. Green, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrees.
Hello.
You know, Minister Farrakhan said in his speech entitled "A Nation Can Rise No Higher Than Its Woman," he said that when men approach women, they should do so with fear and trepidation. And I think that's true, especially in your case, especially because of, you know, your constant search for truth and justice for not only our people, but all people.
I thank you for that.
Well, it's heartfelt. You know,
thank you.
The term white supremacy is all this has been mentioned a few times on your program, and I think that it would behoove those of us who haven't read Dr. Welsing's book, The ISIS Papers, in order to get a clear understanding of just what white supremacy is, and how it works, and how it serves to disadvantage African people. And tied in with that, you know, we were talking about what Carter G. Woodson meant when he, I think it was in 1926, he suggested that we take at least 1 week to study the history of the Negro. And my contention was that when he said study of the Negro, he meant the study of African people throughout time and any place on the earth where we might be or have been. I saw an article in the St. Louis American newspaper that was talking about Woodson and African American History Month. And I'd like to read what part of what the article said. It's very short, but it went like this. Carter G. Woodson spent his career promoting the importance of black history as part of the American story and in context of the birth and evolution of global civilizations. Now, I know this is the conclusion of, you know, one person, and happens to be the same conclusion as mine. And I think it's always good to go back to the original source in order to understand what a person is trying to say to us. So, in the introduction to the 1969 publishing of, or republishing of, The Miseducation of a Negro, there's a quote from the annual report of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, the 1933 report. And 1933 was the same year that The Miseducation of a Negro was first published. And these are Wilson's words. He says, regarding the Negro race as a factor in world culture rather than as an element in a sequestered sphere, the director, speaking of himself, Dr. Woodson, has recently made two trips to Europe to extend the study of the notice taken of Negroes by European authors and artists and to engage a larger number of Europeans and Africans in the study of the past of the Negro. And so I think that his original intent was the study of African people, the same way we're given to study the history of Europeans all over the world and throughout time. And I think that instead of being a victory, what we have now is actually another case of where we think we're taking a step forward, and we're really being, you know, taking two steps backwards.
Well, I mean, your point is well taken, and it's something that a wider view has also been expressed, that this notion of history that the United States propagates is a very, very narrow history, an extremely narrow history. And naturally, as is the case throughout the world, it is history from the point of view of the dominant society, or the conquerors, if you will. History very seldom is taught from the point of view of the vanquished and the conquered. So if, in fact, the United States, and it doesn't understand this, it hasn't embraced the idea that if you are going to forge a nation, unquote, unless, of course, you're dedicated to the idea that you have a nation founded just the way it is operating now, that there is a dominant culture, and you either belong to it or you don't. The ones who belong to the dominant culture are the people who are privileged. The ones who don't belong are the people who are oppressed. Unless that is the arrangement that is desired, the fact is that if you want a far more progressive society, you therefore have to reorganize your thinking. This is one of the things I find, again, with the... If you look at what is going on, there's a lot of people taking all these initiatives, but they reflect the culture, the dominant culture. They do not stretch themselves beyond it. This is the work that has to be done, and I was going to do a special talk about this, especially within the so-called progressive community. Many in the progressive community still operate with this notion of the dominant culture, and they psychologically align with it, and socially align with it, and politically align with it, even as they profess a wider consciousness. So when we have that going on, therefore we have within at least one sliver of our community where there's a possibility of forging gaps and building bridges, we still have the impediments that obtain in the larger society, the notion of the dominant culture versus the subjugated culture. And so that point is very well taken. We see that all these years later, even though this is a logical step, Carter G. Woodson's point of view simply hasn't taken root in the United States. And in my view, it is imperative that the progressive community address this as part of its internal contradictions. I refer to this a lot when we talk about the fact that the Green Party and other parties that could well be avenues of political redress simply do not reach out to these cultures. They still are operating on this dominant culture syndrome, and they will not break with it. So it's a contradiction. Thanks for bringing it up. From Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Greetings to you, Trees, and greetings to the PRN listening audience. Trees, housekeeping rules. Are you going to have Attorney Maddox come back on? You said you were going to try and get him back on for a question and answer session.
Yes.
Are you going to be able to?
Yes.
Okay, you're going to do that. Okay. The next housekeeping rule is that your podcast from Friday, it's not up on the system.
It has been fixed.
Oh, they have fixed it. Okay, that's
right.
Housekeeping rule number two. Number three, are we going to do the Free Mind Fridays?
Well, this is at the end of the day. I just announced earlier in the program. We'll decide that by the end of the day. I've gotten quite a few reactions, and I'm leaving it till the end of the day today before we decide what it is we're going to do.
Okay, you're going to tally
so
up.
So people
the
can get, this is the last day to, quote, vote, unquote, whichever way you want to do it.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Let's get back to the Free Your Mind. Yes, you, Teresa, on this situation with Black history or Black information and it not being incorporated into the dominant society. You see, in order for you to rule exert that dominant control over a people is you have to project your history as being the beginning of time and the end all be all of all histories. Even though European history is the youngest on the planet, but they have projected their history as being the all-pervasive history. You can go anywhere on this continent where a child is not going to sit in a classroom and learn about the British Empire, the Greek cultures, the Romans, and all of this other nonsense that they try to drum into you and tell you that this is what you need to learn because they're going to say, oh, our culture is more, it's a classical culture, it's an advanced culture. But here it is that you're looking at the Africans and the Asian cultures that are thousands or even millions of years old, and they're going to call us as primitive. These are the certain buzzwords that they use when they refer to us as being a primitive people. So here it is that you've managed to survive on this planet for all of these times, and you're being relegated to the role of being a primitive. I happen to watch, I don't know if you all get this channel, it's called an investigative discovery channel, and they had a special that they were doing last night. It's called The Injustice Files, where they were doing a thing on the sundown towns throughout the United States. And I didn't even know, because I live right out here in Dallas. I live right next door to Highland Park, which they said at one time it was a sundown town. It's no longer a sundown town anymore. But they were showing you how these towns with these exclusive covenants, and they still have them in all parts, especially in the north, because every time people hear this idea of these sundown towns where blacks cannot be in these towns after sundown. You can come in here, you can work as maids, but the restrictive covenants restrict you from owning property. You cannot buy a home. You cannot live there in any of these communities. And people are always telling us why it is that we always complaining, why we can't get nothing, and, you know, we're always, you know, crying mealy mouth. It's because when you look at a history like that, where you're going to tell someone that they cannot live in a certain community, or if you do manage to get yourself to the level that they say you need to go, then you're refused, admitted for employment, you refuse to be given an opportunity. It was very, very disheartening to watch that show on yesterday. Also, there was another program on last night talking about, it was called Black Wings on the Smithsonian Channel, where it shows these black aviators, and they always tell you to go join the military, do all of these things. And the first black pilot to fly commercially for Continental Airlines, he had to sue the United States government and take his case up to the Supreme Court in order for him to get hired, because they refused to hire him. They're going to say that white people are not going to feel comfortable having a black man flying a plane. But here it is but you feel comfortable having black people cooking your food to feed you. You're not that so uncomfortable that we could poison you or we could harm your children because you throw these children onto us and say, okay, you're going to take care of our children. But you're concerned that we're going to fly a plane and we're going to do some damage to you up there in the cockpit.
But there are millions of examples of the kinds of things that you're talking about, but we have to understand that these ways of thinking are indispensable to a society founded on the notion of white supremacy or racial superiority and racial, everything else is racially inferior. You have to understand how indispensable it is. Mm-hmm. And because it is indispensable, and it nonetheless is at the foundation of the society, how this society was conceptualized, even before the pilgrims left wherever and decided to land here, even before they set foot on the boats that brought them here, they knew whoever it is that they were going to encounter was just subhuman. And they knew that. Now, how do you begin to turn this around when it is literally ingrained in the DNA of a society? This is how the society was founded. It's the laws are in reinforcing these kinds of thinking. Restrictive covenants still exist. You had this obscenity of inventing this notion of race, which is biologically just impossible, scientifically just impossible, but it has been rationalized. The United States has been functioning on an irrational kind, illogical, unscientific, inhumane, just unphilosophical point of view for a long time, and it has rigidified this way of thinking by ingraining it in the laws. The laws.
Exactly. The institutions.
So it is not going to be so unusual that people still have these things. It is necessary for the society to operate this way. Now, even an allegedly black president, okay, I'm not talking about that, but even a black president, still, you can see evidence that he feels not at all worthy. You can see the implications in his policy that he still is deferring, he still is of service to a system that is racist.
Well, and he's the face of empire, Utrecht. Barack Obama is not running anything. Barack Obama is just the store clerk.
But the point I'm making is to say, for example, that it is a vampire, I believe that the progressive community itself has invented all kinds of ways to avoid the question as to where it stands. the Green Party will not say right out front, one of the pillars is we stand against racism. Unions need to stand up. We stand against racism.
Exactly.
You can't just, you know, I refuse myself. I refuse to watch programs right now on television where you have all these thinkers. When I see an all-white panel, I move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is no way that unless they sign up for it and unless they endorse it, that today you can have a conversation about national issues when you don't see, visually even see, that these people recognize that there's a culture outside of their own narrow definition. So there has to be a revolution, an open revolt against these basic pillars that continue to operate in our society. And we wonder how come we can't make progress. Because there is no willingness to openly defy it.
Not only willingness, Utrice, is these so-called good white people who knows, who sees what's happening and sits on the sideline, because they always want to say, I had no part in it, I didn't do anything. But if you're going to let a small minority of your members do these things because y'all are getting a benefit from it and y'all have not never stepped into it and put a stop to it, you can't tell me that there's only a tiny minority that's doing all of this evil around here while y'all sit back and y'all go condone it. Black people, we are not going to be able to solve this problem. It's going to have to be something that white people are going to have to take on and do internally on their own. This is not going to be any input from us.
Just so you know, I have said it very openly. There are a lot of reporters and journalists who are congratulated because, oh, I went to Kuala Lumpur, I went to East Timor, I went to this place,
mm-hmm.
and I did this and I did this. And I said, you know, all these things don't impress me. You know, you really want to impress me? Tell me. Show me a long list of your appearances in your own racist community where you have instantly
exactly.
and directly confronted your issues. I remember going to a funeral out in Long Island. The father of one of the great heroes of the left had died. And it was amazing. The only black people in at the funeral, and this was supposed to be a very, very liberal person, very progressive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The only black people who were there were the black people who came with me.
Mm. That's normally how it goes.
Absolutely. So, and it was an all-white community. And you can't tell me, I mean, I could show you a long list of meetings. I've gone to community meetings, and I call it as I see it, condemning black leadership right there and telling folks this is the work we have to do. We have the white community has got to do its own work. It has to do its own heavy lifting. It has
exactly.
to confront these contradictions openly because they are an impediment to bridges being made and for people
to their own
get
progress.
Along.
It's
so
their own progress.
We have this going on. You know, if, for example, we have this commitment by some of the organizations out there who say they're progressive and they're liberal and they're doing all this, you know, watchdog work and whatnot, I commend them for that. But then I look at their staff. Michael Moore, great guy, whatnot. Look at his staff.
Majority white.
You know, you look at these things and you say, no. There's got to be, you've got to be kidding me. Thanks, Sarah, for your call.
You're welcome,
Philadelphia, Clara is on the air.
Oh,
hello, Clara.
Thank you. I'm still so lucky to get on. How are you? I just
fine,
dialed.
Thank you.
All right.
Oh, my gosh. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I wanted to add something, some thoughts I've had before, you know, for a long time. I think we need to really look more inward and do our own work from the individual to the family to the community. If we could coordinate ourselves and well enough, we could actually play a large part in bringing the system down. There's nothing in the system that is, in my opinion, that is restorative or renewable or worth saving. We must start over. And the way you start over is you take care of yourself. And I talk to people. It doesn't seem to register. I give examples, and I'm walking the walk. I'm not just talking to people about things they should do. So I'll show you. Let's work together. It starts with our health, and then it goes to our physical and our emotional health. Working for ourselves, we might not ever get jobs again, but we can work and take care of ourselves if we are willing to do it. It's hard work. I don't see any answers in the system. Not just
I agree with you. I think that I believe, and this is my, this has been my experience, on a one-on-one basis, I mean, you find a great deal more openness and you find a lot of progress that you can make on a one-on-one basis.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking, and that should be pursued, but we're talking in terms of a systemic response. What are the institutions that are capable of making a difference, and by leading that effort, by so doing, creating a larger awareness that these impediments have got to be tackled and they have to go? We don't see that systemic response going. We just don't.
I don't either. No, I don't think that we will. The systems that exist are inadequate. They're corrupt. Every major system, education, religion, all of politics, the health, what's left is our own consciousness. And one time that we can work on, that's the only thing we have control over, is our thoughts. Because one time I was talking with you about President Assad being so skilled in the interview, and you and some others said, well, he's a head of state. We're heads of state. We're heads of our minds. We are all heads of state. If we could just get it into our heads, I know it's taken me a long time. I'm an old woman, but I could teach young people. They could learn before I did. I'm just telling you, it's all in ourselves.
Good advice. Thank you, Clara. Thanks so much for your call today. From L.A., DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Idris. How are
Hello.
You this beautiful day?
I thank you. I hope you're well.
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much. I've been sitting here listening, and I totally agree with the lady that just called. And
that's Clara from Philadelphia.
Clara, yeah, we need to start from the bottom up and start locally and divest from the system, because as she indicated, there's not very much left of the system that's worth saving. Every institution seems to be corrupted in one way, excuse me, or another. So I definitely believe that. I wanted to go back to something that your first caller, Harvey, said, no disrespect to Mr. Harvey, but as we point out, you know, it's also time to dump the Democratic Party. And he was making it sound as if, oh, the Republicans are up to this and the Republicans are up to that, as if the Democrats aren't just as corrupt. And like I said, no disrespect to him, but we're dealing with a one-party system here. We don't even have two parties. There are two heads on the same snake, you know. So the only thing we can do is divest from the corrupt political system and this whole system and start over, and that's my thing.
Okay, but that is one half of the issue. What's the other half? I mean, you divest or you withdraw, but what do you as the alternative?
Well, there's a lot of work to be done. And sadly, Utrecht, I fear that the biggest majority of Americans out there are too lazy to do the work that's being done because they're used to everything being spoon-fed to them. I can't tell you how many people I talk to about different issues, and they all they know is how to parrot what's been spoon-fed to them over the CNNs, the MSNBCs, the Fox networks. And we have to get out of that frame of mind, not we, you and I and the listeners to this show, but America's going to have to get out of that frame of mind of having everything spoon-fed to them, and we have to think. And like Clara, I believe, said, you know, we have to realize it's within our minds to change our own reality. You see, so we have to, first of all, the first thing I always tell everybody is get rid of that dang TV. Get rid of that cable satellite. Get rid of that TV because it's nothing but a box full of lies all day long is all it is. So once you do that, you start to clear your head, and then you can think. So after you start thinking, you need to do things like set up your own, as she was saying, also, you know, run our own businesses, run for office in your local, whether it's for the school board or for the city or whatever it be, we have to start from there and build the progressive movement all over again. Because as you indicated, the so-called progressive movement we have now, most of it also is corrupt. I mean, their ideas are in the right place, but they don't always follow through. I'll just put it that way. So,
but I go even further to say that the ideas that they have, in many ways, they're not formed on the basis of consensus either. They're still replicating the pattern that we will do the heavy thinking. We just need you to do the heavy lifting. It's got to stop.
It's got to stop. I mean,
it has got to stop.
Right. And so the thing is, if Americans in general don't wake up and stop buying this nonsense, I'll use that word in place of the word I really want to use.
Yes.
If they don't stop buying this nonsense that's being fed to them, we're doomed. I mean, we're going down like the Titanic right now. We really are. So hopefully we can reach some people. I tell everyone that I know all the time, everyone I meet about your show, I put the information in front of them. So we can, if they'll start listening, we can do some good.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank you, Beatrice. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too. New Jersey's next. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, am I on there? Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, good. I didn't hear my name. Okay, thanks, Beatrice. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. Same here.
I was thinking about all the divisions that we have in our society, and it seems to me there's more division in this period during this administration. There's more class division. I don't think I've ever heard so much talked about class divisions, and it's always been a case through history, but it's just thrown out there again and again now. And I can't remember any time when there was so much division, and it's being institutionalized, in my view, even in the public sector now, in the governmental sector, where, okay, in the private sector, you're waiting at the airline, and some people have advantages of getting on the plane first, getting off the plane, getting better seats. So you have the silver, the gold, and the
bronze.
and so I think now this is becoming institutionalized even in the public sector, with governmental programs. Now we're gold, silver, and bronze there too, and we're dividing ourselves based on economics and classes, and this is happening more today. Which it should be the opposite. It should be less and less, but it's more and more of these divisions, and these fragmentations, and they're being really institutionalized. So we're getting different services based on who we are. If we're the kind of a gold person, we're going to get specialized service, and we're a silver person, we're going to get some less services, and a bronze, you know, person is going to get the minimal services. And this just these divisions just you know, eat away at society. It's really destroying us. And it's not just racial divisions; those are also emphasized. The class divisions, you know, the economic divisions, the religious divisions, which were always there, the cultural divisions. And also the division between the people and the public. So, you know, there have always been these divisions in the past, but the elements, you know, cultural and spiritual, and there were things that mitigated the divisions in the past, I think, that there was a sense that that would, let's say there were civilizing influences, whether those influences were religious at some periods of time, or the rationality of science mitigated some of these divisions and some of our human nature and our awareness, you know, it's just awareness of the past and the horrors of the wars, the World Wars that we learned from our mistakes. And by that learning, we've mitigated some of the divisions between people. But now it seems that we are, these civilizing influences are starting to fray. They're falling by the wayside. And for various reasons, there are less of these influences, and they're disappearing, like religion. You know, people don't believe this kind of thing anymore. And it used to be a mitigating circumstance, but that's going. And it may be good or bad. I mean, we use these things as crutches and band-aids to cover up things in the past. But now, without those mitigating influences, it's become a very raw kind of division. And it's
I like where you're going with this, because you see, you are spotting something that is actually happening, and what I think it is that with certain, I use the word advisedly, with certain progress being made in terms of getting people to bridge that race gap, when you hear what you're hearing, it is a reaction to counteract the progress being made on that level. So whereas there was progress on the race issue, now they brought it back, except it now appears as a class issue. And it is ironic, and this is why it drives me nuts when I hear the president start talking about, you know, the middle class. He's therefore the middle class. What is he talking about? None other than the president of the United States is operating, class warfare. And it is because they figure, well, we are, in fact, in a, quote, post-racial society. You know what I mean? This is a joke, but that's the thinking. So in as much as there has been some progress made there, it is more effective now to pursue what the business of creating divisions, to maintain divisions, because a society has to have them. That's the whole point of what I was talking about in terms of zero sum. You have to have winners and you have to have losers. And in this way of thinking, if it can't be facilitated as it was with the rigidity of race, we will do it with the rigidity of class. So now you have to assign yourself, whereas before you knew, well, I'm either one of them or I'm one of us. Now you have to figure out, well, are you one of them? Do you aspire to be one of them? Are you in the bronze or the gold? Or are you in the silver category? You know, this is a nonsensical thing, but it is absolutely true. You're right on to something there. We are now being divided, compounding the incomplete discussion about race, we're now compounding it with division on the basis of class.
Oh yeah, you know, and I've heard from this president more than any other president, even George Bush or anybody. I've heard more class division talk from Obama than George Bush. I mean,
absolutely.
George Bush said there's the haves and the have-mores, you know.
Right.
But Obama, he's creating all kinds of divisions, you know. Just, you know, I remember at the beginning, you know, he was talking about class, and he said, well, if you're making less than $250,000 or $40,000, you're in a middle class, in a very dismissive kind of way, as if he put himself above that, you know. And he's been emphasizing class more than any other president I can imagine.
But he has no clue. This is an issue. Because for one to discuss class without understanding that it also involves race, you have to have been living under a rock for all of your life. That's the way race and class kind of go together in the United States.
Yes, and I think we have to continue this sometime because I'm very interested in this zero-sum game that you brought up. And it comes from game theory, I believe. But there are other games besides the zero-sum game, and we should discuss that sometime. You know, a zero-sum game is like a pie, and you cut pieces out, and there's less left every time. And if somebody takes a huge piece, there's a small piece for everybody else, you know, and because there's nothing left. It's a zero sum.
It is what informs policy, and I've been looking at this notion for a long time. Not everybody is to have everything, nor should any resource be construed to be available to everyone, so that if you're talking about prosperity, not everybody should have it.
Right.
Automatically, if it is a benefit or if it is something good, you start from the point of view that not everybody should have it. So then you create policies that ensure that not everybody should have it.
Right. But the zero-sum game is not the only game out there. There are other games that don't operate in this fashion. And we should ask ourselves, why did we choose the zero-sum game as the basis of our relationships and our society? If I grow apples and you grow pears and you give me the pears and I give you the apples, that's not a zero-sum game.
No.
But if we all have a money as the thing and we all put it in one pot and some get huge amounts and there's only a little left for somebody else, that's a zero-sum game. Why did we a good discussion in the future might be, why did we choose that game?
Because it's capitalism, and that's what capitalism requires. You can't have equality at all under that system. It is just not designed for everybody to have a benefit.
Correct.
And, you know, there was a time, I guess you could even go back to the 50s, where even in the thinking of the average person, there were certain things that were possible. A guy working at a factory, whatever it is, looked forward to the summer. They could pack up their kids and rover, and they have a little boat that they could trail behind them because they're going to go on a lake and hang out there for the weekend or something like that. And to that person, that was a sense of fulfillment. You have a well-rounded view. You're taking care of your family, your children are happy, you're earning enough to sustain your family, and you can enjoy life as, quote, an American, quote. These things have been shattered. The level and intensity of this zero-sum way of thinking is now punitive because the in the interim has been born a new class of super capitalists, and they are now the gold people. The people who used to be the gold people, but in money terms, are now the silver people.
Right, heading towards the bronze.
we are probably like tin foil. Do they have a tin foil category? That would be us. We're not even tin. We're just tin foil. That's where
we're on a slippery slope, let's put it that way.
So in this way of thinking, we are schooled to accept the limits of what it is we can do and what it is we can expect, what it is we can hope for, what it is we can achieve. And we are supposed to accept it. When you have a president of the United States running around saying, I'm for the middle class, our reaction should be, then I can't vote for you. I'm the tinfoil people. I can't vote for you. You're not talking to me.
Well, we don't. Actually, you have brought up a good point in the past, too. Like, what is this middle class that they keep referring to? It's a very nebulous term. It used to have a meaning. You know, it used to mean something, I suppose. But today, it means nothing.
Well, the middle class, Jimmy Carter said, he noted that the people being called middle class looked like the people who were higher up on the ladder just a couple of years ago. And those people are now middle class people. The middle class blacks, if he's referring to blacks in middle class, we had Professor Cohen earlier on last year talking about the fact that 70%, close to 70% of blacks considered middle class have zero assets. So, you know, what are we talking about here?
Really? I mean,
they're just reconfiguring the terms to achieve the same objectives.
No
change in the attitude that essentially this society will never tolerate relatively equal access to strategic resources nor the distribution of such resources.
Well, yes, and I'm afraid, you know, Gary mentioned on his show, I heard the term late-term capitalism or the late part of capitalism, and maybe that's a kind of a Marxist analysis, capitalism. But I feel like whatever that means, I'm not a student of
like
that.
Like cancer, you know, you have early stages of cancer.
Right.
And you have
stage four capitalism.
Yeah.
We're at the end of it because it's like a snake eating its own tail. It's like chewing itself up. So I'm afraid.
Well, that's what happens. But the thinking also is, as long as it doesn't happen in my lifetime, I'm good with it.
Yeah, but it's things are progressing very rapidly now.
How policymakers think. As long as it doesn't happen while I'm around, and maybe even say my grandchildren, I'm good with it.
Well, that's a general sense. You know, we're using up our resources and just destroying everything, and you know, we're short-term thinkers in that regard.
Sure. I mean, how is it possible that anybody in a major policy position like the president or a senator or a member of Congress, how could you feel okay with the idea of, quote, compromise on whether people have enough to eat? I mean, how do you think that that's a good idea, that you can actually, with a straight face, say, we have compromised on this and we're taking $8 billion out of the bellies of people who have nothing to eat. And one in seven people in the United States are depending on these food stamps for
feeding themselves. Because they term it as a term, responsibility. You know, if you remember, Mitt Romney said, well, you know, these people don't take responsibility for their lives. Remember that in the 47% speech? They don't take responsibility for their lives. So responsibility is taken to mean that you rapaciously go after money and power and position and authority, and you're responsible. So that defines responsibility.
Unbelievable. That's where we are as a society right now. And therefore, all the more important that those organizations that are in a position to, you know, they have the wherewithal to influence. They operate in spheres of influence. And this is why the pressure should be put on them. They have got to carry this banner, whether they want to or not. They're supposed to do it because that is very critical. Along with the policymaking is also the way the policy informs attitudes. And if we come to the point where, you know, you deal with the have-nots constantly as constantly as a problem, you know, where in advocating, even advocacy groups are part of this, they continue to parrot this way of presenting the communities as these are the problem people that we are advocating for. No, you are fighting against an inhumane policy. That's what
right,
needs
right.
to be done.
That's
Thanks
right.
so much for calling.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot. Great
Pleasure.
Talking with you. Thank
right.
you. So we've come to the end of our program today. Again, by the end of the day today, I would really like that we decide whether we're going to have this on Tuesdays or Fridays, so we make a decision on that. I just want to read this quickly from someone who sent in, Nathaniel. As is currently in the mind of the dominant society, so it is in our reality, he says. That part of the brain that deals with dividing up the people is sick, and therefore that part of our reality is sick. Once you fix this part of the mind of the dominant, he's saying basically that all would be much better. Thank you, Nathaniel, for that. All right, so we come to the end of the program. Stay tuned. Richard Wolf is next with economic update, so you want to stay tuned for that. And reach me at leadstories@gmail.com on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. So one more time, this may very well be the last Tuesday that we hold this, the way things are going. I'm still waiting. We kind of are at a tie right now. And by the end of the day, we'll understand what we will do come March with respect to this. Tomorrow, the IRP 6, you may want to tune in because tomorrow we're taking questions. And then on the final chapter, we will get about the case. The case is being handled, by the way, by Mark Garagos. He has taken personal interest in this case. That is a very, very strong point for the people who are in jail, but we will get to that eventually. And on Friday, I want to do a special talk, kind of summing up where we have been for this month and some of the themes that we touched on. I'll be basically talking a bit about that on Friday. And a great program on Thursday. We will have with us a very special guest talking about what this Obamacare is going to do to many, way too many people, forcing them into a state of utter defenselessness economically. All right. So thanks so much for being with me today. It is a pleasure always and a privilege to be in your company. I seriously mean that. I really regard this time together as sacred time because it is important for you to, you know, put your two cents in, and we don't have to have a theme. The theme is as you see fit, and that too is a contribution to the larger business of opening up dialogue so we could appreciate our points of view. It is not important whether people agree or disagree. What is important is that we appreciate the complexity of ideas. We can see where people's individual journeys have brought them. And so every thought is valid. So I don't want you to think that you necessarily have to agree or disagree, or that it is somewhat bad to agree or disagree. No, it's just about you and your ideas. Thanks. Bye-bye.